Welcome to the Rise Network podcast show, a podcast dedicated to help you reach your dream lifestyle through investing in real estate. We're going to be sitting down with new, intermediate, and experienced investors to talk all about real estate and how it has changed their lives. If you're looking to scale your portfolio or even just get into real estate investing, you're in the right place. Make sure to tune in.
What's going on, everyone? Welcome to the Rise Real Estate Investing Podcast with Mayu Thaba and
Austin Yeh. How's everything going, man? What have you been up to?
I was just about to be like, what's your boy, Mayu Thaba? Who the fuck is the guy with radio shows? Things are going good, man. Things are going good. It's been a busy month. I completely forgot it's a long weekend this weekend. So this is a much needed 4-day vacation, 4-day break. Other than that, the mortgage.
Wait, hold on. 4 days is Monday? Oh, yes, for the banks. Monday is
all. Holiday, bro.
It's going to be. That's right. Yep.
It'll be all about bookkeeping this weekend. But dad is like, whatever. Dad's giving me shit because he's doing some of my corporate account for me. But aside from the mortgage business, real estate, I think we talked about last week, got my non-payment of rent tenant going on there. So I'll probably deal with them in April. I got to really head up to my curriculum, like 9 bucks, and negotiate some vacancies ASAP. I was supposed to go up there in early March. I've just been putting it off so much. And then my cottage Airbnb, I got a 4-star rating from a guest when I fully refunded her first stay. That cheesed me. I gave you a refund. But my hot water tank stopped working and she was being really nice and understanding about it. And then I gave her the refund thinking, okay, this will probably stop her from giving me bad review, and she still gave me a 4-star, and I was like, you little whatever. Yeah. So other than that,
well, hold on, do you explicitly call out a 5-star review, like, hey, sorry, this couldn't be a 5-star, this couldn't be a 5-star stay, hoping that this makes things better if I refund you the entire amount, something like, you know, sell.
I said something like that. It was like, you know, really sorry that this negatively impacted your experience. I'm like, We're more than happy to refund you for your trip in exchange for X, Y, and Z issues, right? But then I talked to Airbnb support. They were saying just because I refunded her for the issue doesn't mean that she can't leave me a review because the review is meant to reflect her experience. So I was like, all right, let me pay the probability here, because if I knew I was going to get a 4-star review, I would have just kept the freaking money. You know, like.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But it might have been a 1 or 2-star after that.
Yeah.
I feel like you got it like low key, sort of slide it in there without being too explicit with it, right? Because some people get turned off by that too.
At this point, like, we've had so many issues with this like place, and it's fully renovated, but now like we just replaced a water tank into like a Reliance water tank. The problem is essentially like technician. Right. So you can't get an electrician over the weekend. You can't get a plumber. You need an electrician to deal with the water tank issue. And so then I just swapped out to Reliance. I'm like, you know what? Now it's your problem to make sure an electrician comes. And so I called Reliance on Saturday morning. They were supposed to come out Saturday night. They didn't come out. Called them again Sunday. I'm like, yo, gave them some shit. I'm like, I got some tenants here. Like, this doesn't make sense. And then they gave me the contractor's number. Called the contractor. He didn't answer. He called me back at like 6 p.m. He's like, yo, I was busy today, blah, blah, blah. I was just like, but you can't even be rude, right? So I was like, oh, no, I totally understand, man. When do you think you can get out there? And he's like, maybe tomorrow. And then I called him at like Monday at like 2 p.m. I'm like, hey, man, like, just wondering when you're going to go out there. He's like, I already went out. I already swapped it out. I'm like, what? Like, this is ridiculous now. But whatever.
Did he actually, though?
Yeah, he did, because cleaner checked, but I guess he went in between the cleaner and in between the gas, so no one knew that he went in there and did this shit.
Interesting.
That's what I've been doing. What have you been up to?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the same. getting through taxes, I mean, the trust, what are the new trust rules where you have to follow the T3? We're not accountants, so I don't want to speak too deep into it, but it seems like it is going to be a pretty big headache for us. Like pretty much the vast majority of our properties, we're going to need to file that. That is going to be a pretty significant expense. I mean, the quotes we're getting from accountants range anywhere from $400 on the cheap end all the way to like $1,100 on the higher end. And this is on a per trust basis. So if you have multiple properties with multiple JV partners, you're going to have to file one for each one. So that's been, I don't want to say a source of stress, because they are waiving the penalties for it this year, it seems like, but it's been annoying that we have to think through that. Plus the UHT filings as well that we got to work on, for April.
So UHT, we're fine. UC, we've already filed. Oh, for 2023.
For 2020. Yeah. So we're going to have to do it this year. It doesn't take a whole ton of time, but it's just very irritating. Like, how much compliance do we need to do? Taxes itself is a pain in the ass, to be honest. So all of this extra stuff is just driving me nuts.
Yeah, being compliant is a choice, Austin.
There was an article that was shared in our mastermind group. One of the accountants that we have in the mastermind group shared an article saying that, like, hey, like, most Canadians are just probably not even going to be compliant with this trust because most of them are probably unaware of it. A lot of people who are not investors, I bet you they're going to completely grease to the fact that they might have to file it for maybe just one property that they own.
It's the potential penalties that to me screams like money grab here.
Oh yeah.
Which is like the biggest freaking concern. Like, those are like 5% of your fair market value as a potential penalty. Now, what's the likelihood that they actually give you a full 5% like that? Most people would fight that like crazy, right? But even if you end up settling at like 1% or 2%, those are drastic penalties, right? But yeah, man, exactly. Most people don't know, man. Like, I've been talking to some of my clients and I'm like, yo, like, I think you guys need to file this shit. Don't take my word for it. Talk to your accountant. But pretty sure you need to file this. So
yeah. Pretty much, if you have a partner in anything and you're both non-entitled, maybe talk to your accountant to just verify if that's the case. And even if it's not an investment, like if you're, for me and my primary, my fiance's entitled, I'm not entitled, we're going to speak to our accountant because more than likely we might have to file something for it, even if it's our primary. We will probably be exempt, right? But we still probably have to do some sort of paperwork to show accordingly. But that's been annoying. Tenant situation. I think I was trying to remember if I talked about this previous episode, but if not, basically I had a non-paying tenant and, we have our hearing. There are so many non-paying tenants. I feel like a fucking news story all the time. I think
you did. You talked about this last time, but let me ask you this. What percentage of your, because this is completely random, but slightly related to what you were talking about.
Right.
What percentage of your portfolio do you think turns around every year? Whether it's from non-payment or like just tenants leaving or like whatever, like what percentage do you think it is?
I don't know. Let me think. So we have a fiveplex about, trying to think. Three of the tenants turned over in the first year and a half.
Like, not from cash for keys. This is like natural.
No. Yeah, this is not. Yeah, they all got cash for keys. We fully tenanted and three turned over. One of them was unable to afford it anymore, but we're able to get someone else there in there. So there was no vacancy cost, thank God. The other one was a non-payment. This was the police constable that I was mentioning earlier.
Okay.
They left. I reached back out to them and I let them know, I was like, hey, this is the situation. We have a court hearing for June. Like, can we work something out? They left without telling me after not paying rent. But after they got that email from me and I laid out, you know, I always talked about it, but laying out what could eventually happen. They said, look, I'm still willing to work things out with you. But it's a sad situation for sure. I don't think they're lying. They got divorced and the wife took everything. They're illegally, right? She just took everything from their joint account. So he's like, dude, like, I'm moved back with my parents right now.
Dude, imagine robbing a cop.
I know.
Yeah.
And the guy can't do anything as well, right? Like, this is like, he has to go through court. Yeah. He still has to go through court. But it's fucking insane, man.
So you're saying 3 out of 5, but those are all at market rent. So, but this was my, like, when I was looking at stuff, I was like, probably about like 8 to 15%, depending, right? I have like longer, like non-paying tenants that I've just left in some properties and I'm perfectly fine with whenever they turn around. And the reason this is relevant is when you're looking at like larger commercial buildings, it's okay. It's like, what percentage can you underwrite or can you assume will naturally turn over from non-payment of rent or just debt, divorce, moving for a job, blah, blah, blah.
I think one thing that you can do is you can get like the list of all the tenants and how long they've been there. If all the tenants have been there for 5+ years, what are you going to underwrite? The last 10, the newest tenant that moved in was 5 years ago and no one has left since. So to underwrite anything wouldn't be necessarily prudent, right? But if you see some people come in 2 years ago and then someone 10 years ago, someone like 5 years ago, 8 years ago, 1 year ago, it's like, okay, there's some turnaround here. But yeah, I mean, sometimes I look at the what do you call it, the pro forma, and then I get the analysis on, not analysis, but information on the tenants. Like, dude, they've all been here for at least 5 years plus. So like, I got a cash for keys at them. Otherwise, I don't think any of them are going to leave. Like, what's going to make a difference when I go in there, right?
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's fair enough, man. This is one deal in Kitchener. It sold for like 950 or 960 or something for a 5 unit. And it was all like disgustingly like under market rented. And a 5 unit, no matter what you do, like you can't, because it's three units or less for like personal possession.
Right.
I see the camera, I'm doing quote unquote, right? But yeah, so there's literally like no guaranteed approach there. So I was like, kind of thinking about what the heck I would do here. Like, what do I even underwrite? Maybe I get none of them out, right? And the deal just doesn't make sense. But the moment you get one out, huge, huge lifts, right? So completely random, but.
Is there any upside potential? Do you think someone's in there like adding a basement suite or what's going on there? Or is it really when you're looking at it, it's the highest and best use is to keep it as is and turnover unit?
No, I think that one, there was development opportunity in the back.
Okay.
But it's kind of like a weird, like long-term down the road, if you bought out like another lot, could you like develop right. on it? Yes. Do you really want to develop on it in its as is condition? Like probably not, but maybe someone would do it. Like,
right. Yeah, again, like the way that we underwrite is obviously, but like good. For me even more so than you, I'm way towards the risk adverse side, right? And yeah. I would still consider yourself relatively risk adverse too, right? Because we honestly haven't done a deal for a while, although we've been searching. Is this either we get outbid or we just way too strict in our criteria? And that sort of sets us back at times, right? But also, it's not always a bad thing. There was another... We won't touch on it too much. Like, we don't like to speak on the drama, but there's another sort of like bankruptcy that came about from like a larger investor in a big group, right? A big group. And that's because they've obviously scaled up aggressively. So, I mean, it feels like shit a lot of times, but also when we hear news like that, it's like, okay, like our portfolio might not be perfect, but I don't feel like I'm stressed that I'm going to lose everything at no point in time, right? And I'm sure it's likewise for you.
Yeah. No, that's true. That's true. And I think not being like balls deep in like real estate, like dependent on the income also helps as well, right? Like,
right.
Your like housing costs are pretty limited. Mine are pretty limited as well, right? Like, so all that, there's kind of like multiple different factors here, right? Like, right. I'd say lifestyle creep's another big part of why people like blow through their funds, right? And I don't think either one of us are necessarily living well beyond our means. Yo, dude, did you get a car? Like, it's like,
you got
the CRV recently. You get a new car?
You saw me in a CRV?
Yeah.
What?
At a mastermind.
Oh, no, that's my fiance's car, man. yeah. No, my car is in repair right now, so that will take a while.
True. Okay, interesting.
Yeah, fucking, the Teslas take forever, man. Well, you thought...
Tough times.
You thought times were tough, man. You thought I had to sell the Tesla.
Austin's struggling out here. You should probably check in with it.
I'm so upset you never even asked me. You just assumed that. You probably
A nice CRV. It wasn't like an old rickety ass CRV.
No, dude, I know what you want. You went into another group chat and told everyone Austin's struggling right now. He's next on the bankruptcy. This Tesla's gone. Enough joking around from us. We're going to jump into today's podcast. We have our special guest, George L. Massery. You guys might have heard his name around. He's been in the real estate industry for a while, actually has his own podcast, the Well Off Podcast, which I was recently, I did a podcast with him recently. I think you're going to do one next month as well. He is an experienced real estate investor spanning with experience over a decade, starting off with small single family projects, as most of us do, but most recently has jumped into an 11 unit building. And also is currently working on a 4 side-by-side townhouse project where he's adding ADUs on each one and then eventually going to convert it over to CMHC, take it over to a CMHC loan. So we get into so many different interesting strategies, how he was able to adapt and grow organically through his own portfolio, then eventually take on partners and eventually work on bigger stuff. And then we get into some of the troubles that George faced because some of these properties that he purchased was prior to the rate hike environment. And obviously rate hikes had caught us all off guard. So he had to pivot along the way with some of these bigger projects, but was able to successfully do so. A lot of golden nuggets in this episode. Before we jump in, make sure to leave us a 5-star review, comment, share with a friend. I think we have like 130 reviews on Spotify. So we've been pretty flat. Let's try to get that to 150. And without further ado, we'll jump right on in. Just a heads up before we get started, this podcast is all about providing you information, not financial or legal advice. So if you need the real deal for your situation, hit up a professional. We can't promise you our information is always up to date or accurate, and we're not responsible for any investment decisions you make based on it. Markets change, information change, you know the drill. Anyways, thank you for hanging out with us responsibly. Let's jump right on in. Hello, everyone. We are joined with our very special guest, George L. Massery. George, really appreciate you jumping on, man. How's everything going?
everything's going well. Just, you know, getting the day started. I got to make sure I get my workout in this morning. It's been kind of hard. We got a newborn. So yeah, just adjusting to that.
You're working out from home?
Lately I've been going more like on walks, on the treadmill at the gym, just running a little bit, just working on the cardio.
Well, cool. Yeah. For anyone that doesn't know George is a name that's been in the investing community, I'd say, for quite some time. I've definitely heard of you. This is my first time actually meeting you, George, but I think I'm getting on your podcast in April or something like that. But he's got a quite successful podcast as well, and he's quite the successful investor that we're going to kind of touch on some of his projects that he's working on today. But for anyone that might not know you, George, why don't you give everyone a quick background on yourself, what you've been up to, and kind of your origin story?
Yeah, sure. So quick background. I was a student at the University of Toronto a couple years ago, over 10 years ago. And I picked up a part-time job while I was doing that. So it was for a tech company called Flip, or at least it's Flip today. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that app. So I worked with them before they were Flip. They were called Wasabi at that point. They were just a startup. After I graduated from university, I was offered a full-time job with them. Didn't love the job, but I just thought, you know, this is easy. Let's just do that for now. Couple months later, I get fired because I'm not passionate about the job. I felt like this huge relief, this huge weight off my shoulders, because I was thinking about quitting for a long time anyway. And then that got me into thinking about what do I want to do next. And that led to getting my real estate license with the intention of investing in real estate, because that was always kind of in my part of my plans and whatnot. So 2013, I get licensed as a realtor, buy my first property in 2017, do a lot of the work myself. It was an old, like 100-year-old house, lots of issues there. I got to do a lot of the work and learn how to use tools and install flooring and that sort of thing. And then just every year from then, just growing a little bit. And we're at the point now where we closed on an 11-unit building in September 2023. And we're working on adding some more units to that building and, you know, turning over some units and that sort of thing.
Awesome. So, I mean, obviously, earned your stripes throughout that process. I'm just curious, when you were when you're starting off, there were a couple of years you're active as a realtor. Was that more so, I mean, obviously you're passionate in it, but was that sort of like how you were accumulating capital to get into your first project in 2017, or why not jump in sooner than later?
Yeah, I actually really struggled in the beginning as a realtor. Like my first year, I think I only sold one house, and thankfully I was living with my parents at that point, didn't have a lot of expenses. Second year was a little bit better, but I actually used to DJ, do weddings and stuff like that to make some extra cash to get by, because it was such a struggle for me. So I didn't have a lot of savings in my first like 2 years or so. By 2017, 4 years in, I was able to scrape together about 25 grand. And that's the money I used to buy my first property. I also got some help from my dad. He loaned me a little bit of money, so I was able to renovate that property and refinance it.
That's pretty cool. And I think even going back to your origin story of, you know, having worked at Flip and getting laid off, like, I think that's something that a lot of us have some sort of like pivotal moment where we just go, something's got to change, right? And that's kind of what's the highest leading motivation. Because being a realtor doing one transaction back in 2013 to 2017, right? Like that era was not $1 million homes, right? It was, I don't know, $500,000 homes or something like that, right?
Yeah.
But how did you get started as a realtor? Like, obviously at that age, you're what, like 23, 24, something like that, right?
Yeah.
How do you go about like getting your first set of clients? I'm sure we do have a decent amount of realtor clients that listen to this podcast and probably wondering the same thing while people debating it.
Yeah. So you're right. 2013, I was 23 years old. Didn't have a lot of people on my network that were moving at that particular time. So I started cold calling, which a lot of people do. I don't necessarily recommend it, but I did a lot of that my first year. The only house I sold was from cold calling. And then the second year, I did a lot of door knocking. So I would door knock for 3 hours a day, 4 to 5 times a week. It was like I was going through shoes like crazy. You know, it was hard work. But I think I did like maybe 4 transactions that year, maybe 5. So I could see things were starting to pick up. And then from there, you know, you adjust and eventually became more of a referral style business. So I worked hard through a program to get more referrals by, you know, doing certain things, by establishing relationships with people and asking people to introduce me to others who were thinking about buying or selling. So that's how I got started. And I kept doing that until probably around 2019, when my wife and I, we agreed, like, I'm just going to focus on investing. She's also a realtor. She'll focus on generating deals so that we can put food on the table, basically.
That's awesome. Yeah, you need both to go hand in hand, right? Because investing is a great wealth builder in terms of cash flows. It's debatable. It takes more money than it gives you in cash flow in the short term, that's for sure. I know we're focusing a little bit on the origin story. We do want to jump into what you're working on today, but I'm just curious. So a lot of people say that on the first project, they put sweat equity and they learn on the job. I mean, you're buying a 100-year-old house where I imagine there's a ton of work that's even out in the scope of what you're comfortable doing. So like, how do you even go about learning or beginning to learn about doing renovations that are quite extensive?
Yeah, I honestly didn't have that much knowledge. I didn't know the market that well. It was in Hamilton, which a lot of people have, you know, kind of started there. I just saw it was a good price. I had looked at other markets at that time. I was looking at Orangeville. I had submitted an offer on a semi-detached there, but I actually couldn't even qualify for that mortgage. So I tied it up and then the mortgage broker said, no, you can't qualify for this. So I'm looking around what price point makes sense. And Hamilton had some opportunities that fit the bill. So that's why I went there. I walk into this house. There's fleas. There's cockroaches. There's water in the basement. There's all these things, right? And I'm so clueless at that point. I have no idea what I'm getting myself into. I'm like, oh, this seems like a good project, you know, a good price. Let's do it. I can fix all these problems. So, you know, as things are developing, you start realizing maybe I've taken on too much. But you just have to get through it at that point. You have no other choice. Like the alternative is failing, and that was never going to be the case.
Listen, how did you know about like the entire investing side, right? Because like normal people, first property, like my first property was a semi in Ajax that was dated, but I wouldn't say like anything compared to the shit that we buy today, right? And I feel like today, because of social media, people know, hey, it's dilapidated. Like that's not necessarily like a bad thing, right? But how did you go about learning about investing? Did you have like family members or friends that were in the space? Where did you hear about it? Was it bigger pockets and all that kind of stuff? Or just curious that.
No. So the funny thing is at that point, I was starting to like seek out investors because I didn't know anyone that did this, right? I went on Google and I started thinking, how do I connect with investors? There weren't necessarily as many podcasts at that point. So this is 2016 probably. But anyway, I type like we buy homes, cash, that sort of thing. And I reach out to about 10 or 15 people, like just cold call people. A lot of people turned me down. Some people were rude to me. But there was this one guy who said, hey, I'll have coffee with you. Let's meet here. I go, I sit down with him. And he explains the Burr strategy to me. And then I had never heard of it. And I'm like, wow, this makes so much sense. And I can absolutely do this. Thank you so much for like, why did you just share all this with me for no reason? Right. And he was just like, I'm still in touch with him today. A lot of you guys probably know him, but it's Sandy McKay.
Yeah.
So
that's pretty cool.
Yeah. So from that point on, I'm like, this is exactly what I want to do. This is the answer I was looking for. I don't have any family members or anyone that's doing this. I just did it based on the information I got during that coffee meeting.
Awesome. Awesome.
And so that first house that you bought, that was a single family house or was that a duplex or?
Yeah, it was legally it was a single family, but it was being used at one point as an illegal duplex.
Gotcha.
Okay. Yeah. And just before we move on, where is this property today? I'm always curious, is that first property still in your portfolio or have you sold on and moved on to bigger things?
Yeah, I just sold it a few months ago, and that was to help finance the building that we bought.
What were the gains on that property, if you don't mind me asking?
Yeah, so purchased it for $215,000 in 2017. I put a lot of sweat equity in, so you know, initially I had put maybe like $15,000, but that was purely for materials and then all my labor, and then I had put another maybe around $30,000 after that, maybe $40,000 after that. And then sold it for $530,000 a couple months
ago. Not a bad return.
Yeah, obviously, if the timing was a little better, like at the height of the market, it was probably worth like $650,000, $670,000. But, you know, I'll take the $530,000. It works.
Absolutely.
The reality is, if had you sold it at that time, you would have bought a little bit more expensive of an asset as well, right? You buy low, sell low, buy high, sell high. Like it's never
But also, I could have poured that money into an existing project that we have. Like that's another case for us, right? But you can't get things done exactly as you should or to maximize the profit. But here's the thing. When I refinanced that first property, I got a line of credit for about $80,000 and I bought a second property with that line of credit. And that was actually an extremely successful investment. And by pure luck, I bought this one bedroom detached bungalow in Hamilton as well for $182,000. I literally just painted it, like painted the interior and a little bit of the exterior. And I sold that place maybe 2 years later for $403,000. The gain on that was way better. Yeah. But it was just pure luck.
So we know you're doing like a 11 unit now and a couple other interesting projects that we're going to dive into, right? But on a high level, between more so to give everyone kind of like a timeline or a roadmap is probably the right word here. So you did the single family house in 2017. What were the projects that kind of came after that to lead to a point where you're comfortable to take down the 11 unit?
Yeah. So I mentioned that second property that I bought. And at that point, I think I hired a coach, a real estate investment coach. And he started changing everything. Like everything changed from that point. I started learning about incorporating. I got access to more lines of credits, like more capital. He taught me how to raise capital, everything, right? And he pushed me like, what? Why do you have to keep going after these smaller properties? Why not go after something a little bigger? And I did these campaigns, flyer campaigns, yes. Targeted campaigns, actually. And I ended up picking up a fiveplex in Welland and a fourplex in St. Catharines within a few months. And then, you know, we did renovations on those, refinanced them as well. So same story. And it just kind of kept building from there. Again. And the way that, to answer the second part of your question, the 11 unit, the only reason that I felt confident enough to do that was that same coach that I had hired. He offers courses from time to time, like once or twice a year. And I took his apartment investing course. And then from there, I just, you know, learned tons. It was worth every single dollar. And that gave me the confidence to go after something a little bit bigger.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, when you're taking that next level up, you want to learn from experts. You want to surround yourself with experts, right? And it's even for people who are just getting started investing. Sometimes we see them jump into a coaching program and take action like pretty quickly just because they're motivated and they're financially invested as well. That being said, I mean, I kind of don't even want to glaze over what you were doing between now and into the 11 unit, because I mean, fourplexes, fiveplexes, I think that's the stage that a lot of our audiences are still in, right? So yeah. You mentioned that you put out some marketing. How did you target these multifamily properties in your marketing? Because I find that at least with a lot of wholesalers, including myself, when we're sending out these letters, a lot of the people who call are single family, maybe duplex, maybe triplex, but definitely rarely do you get 5, 6, 4 unit owners calling.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, also a lot of them are under corporations, right? So it's a little bit harder to directly contact them. But I did a bunch of different things. Like I would drive around, take note of any properties I saw that I was interested in, write down the address, do a little bit of research. I even in the past, I've had assistants like do some digging to some VAs in the Philippines or wherever, find as much information. Cause I'm, like I said, it's very targeted. So I want to know about these specific properties. It might be like 25 to 50 properties. Image. And then I would write them a handwritten note to every single one and send it to them and tell them basically like, I'm looking to buy, call me if you have any interest. And I think that handwritten note was really one of the key factors here, because everybody has received those letters from wholesalers that basically, you know, they will buy your house cash or whatever. And I know sometimes people will emulate that handwritten note, but you can kind of tell, right? You can tell it's printed. Mm-hmm. That was the key. And then once I got on the phone with them, I had a whole procedure, just like a wholesaler would. And we'd go meet at the property and take it from there.
Awesome. Perfect. Yeah, that's interesting, right? Because we don't see as many wholesale deals on the multi side, but it seems like you weren't working from your laptop, right? You were actually going out there and driving through properties and writing the address down. You were doing work that wasn't necessarily glamorous, but you have to be boots on the ground to get these sort of deals.
Yeah, at that point, that's what I was focusing on, like just finding these multis, because that was also when the market was on fire. Right. So you're talking about around 2019, 2020. Multiple offers on everything. They're holding offers. Nobody's just like letting their properties go. People were holding out, waiting for the price they wanted. So off market was kind of the only way to get a good deal. Not the only way, but it was one of the best ways to get a really good deal on a property.
And you're doing cash for keys, or these are vacant?
No, most of them. Well, you would get maybe one vacant unit out of 4 or 5, and then you'd have to work out the rest. But that was a huge learning curve for me too, because I had zero experience with cash for keys, with negotiating with tenants. I had no clue what I was doing, and I ran into a lot of issues on some of these properties actually.
Dublin. So because you were already in the 4 and 5 space, like, were you essentially scaling with like commercial financing, or what's the avenue there that you were going on the financing side? Because it sounds like you're going at a loan. Doesn't sound like you had many JV partners. Maybe you were like raising capital, but not JV side, right? So just wondering how you grew your portfolio.
Yeah. So there was our first JV partnership was on the fourplex in St. Catharines, actually. But for the fiveplex, we had gone with RBC because they were the only A lender that would finance a 5 unit under a residential mortgage. But now I'm just about to close on a CMHC commercial mortgage on that same property. So that's been a huge blessing, because, you know, at this point we're struggling so much to qualify for residential mortgages. It's so much easier on the commercial side. You get 40-year M, good rates. Right. Like, I'm so happy that this fiveplex actually qualifies for that. So it's been great.
It's standard or MLI?
Standard.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. So from there, you kind of just jumping ahead. So obviously the realtor business has, I'm assuming, grown quite a bit over the last 5 years, 6 years, right? Since 2017, when you were doing it full time. What kind of markets are you covering today? What kind of strategies are you seeing working in today's market in those areas?
Yeah, well, my wife is mostly the one that's working as a realtor at this point. So she's in Vaughan, Brampton, Toronto. For me, I'm interested more so in working with people that are looking to get into multifamily, commercial multifamily, so 10 plus units. And markets that I work in are the ones that we invest in. So Brantford, Hamilton, and the Niagara region.
Okay, gotcha. And obviously, like, the areas that you're investing in, a lot of people say that the numbers are tough to make work nowadays, right? Mm-hmm. So obviously you pivoted your strategy. You're not doing these 3s, 4s, et cetera, because again, like, once you refi them, cash flow is pretty much null for the most part. So walk us through how you ended up getting into your first big project that we alluded to earlier, and like, be as detailed as possible, because I think that our audience gets a lot of value from like following that journey along to how you end up getting that deal under contract, the due diligence, the financing, the mentorship along the way. Yeah, mm-hmm. share that entire ride with us.
Yeah, so the 11 unit building, last year at the beginning of the year, I had an assistant compile a list of real estate agents that have had or currently have apartment buildings for sale. So she put a spreadsheet together, their emails, their numbers, and then I said, okay, reach out to these agents and please ask them if they have any pocket listings. So we sent out a bunch of emails. A couple people have responded to us. Some of the opportunities were overpriced, but there was this one property in Brantford that looked interesting. They were asking $2.2 million for it. It was an 11 unit. So I go, okay, let's go take a look. We see it and it looks really nice. You know, they did a good job. It's not dilapidated by any means. It's pretty nicely taken care of, but it's a little overpriced. So we start negotiating from there. It takes about a month and a half to get all the terms worked out. It's a little bit longer with apartment buildings, but we agree on 2 million. We agree on a VTB for 1.3 million at 4.5% interest for 2 years. And then it bumps up to 6% interest for the final 3 years, fully open. So we can refi anytime. We get a second mortgage as well on that.
Don't want to interrupt, but like that, I am interrupting though. But you said negotiating for 1 month. Yeah. What is that like? What does that negotiation look like for that month period? Because were they just like, yeah, we're going to talk with other buyers, not just you. Like, can you share some more details around that?
Yeah, to be honest, I don't really remember why it took so long. I think the biggest thing was the VTB, because they didn't really want to do a VTB in the beginning. So we had to negotiate. They wanted a higher rate. So we said we compromised on the 4.5 for 2 years. And then the price. So they went from 2.2 to 2 million. So all of these terms, you know, we'd go back and forth. We would chat. I don't remember. Oh, and vacant possession, actually. They had one vacant unit, but we were trying to get a couple more. So we ended up with 3 vacant units on closing. And then we also had a permit, which was provided by the existing seller, for a 12th unit. They had an approved building permit for a 12th unit. So all of these things were coming into play. Yeah, I guess that's why it took so long.
I think the reality is, like, especially when you're dealing with off-market multifamily sellers, it's like, are you really motivated? Might not be. It's one of those things where, hey, like, I'd sell it, but like, I don't necessarily need to sell it, right? Especially if you've owned it for a really long period of time. So things are just slower to move, it sounds like. You mentioned there, so when you were going through the due diligence process, obviously, you started off with a list of realtors, commercial realtors that had properties on the market, reached out to all of them, kind of windled it down to this property in Bradford, right? And you mentioned it's overvalued. Were you making reference to kind of like a cap rate, like net income based approach valuation, or was it price per unit, or how did you go about, like, what was kind of the numbers that you were arriving at versus what they were asking for?
Yeah, it was definitely the income approach. So net operating income, cap rate, that sort of thing. And this was a relatively new market for me. I had been to Brantford a couple times. Like, I've had clients that have bought smaller properties there, but I've never really looked at commercial multifamily there. So I wasn't too familiar with the cap rate. So I had to do a lot of digging on that. But yeah, my valuation was, if I remember correctly, in the mid 1.9 million, so $1,950,000, somewhere around there. But they were factoring in that 12th unit that they had the permit for.
Right.
So it's not exactly super easy to determine the value of that. But yeah, I mean, it obviously factors in. It's probably at least a $50,000 valuation for that permit. So yeah, that's kind of where we were at, and they wanted a little bit more. But back to your comment about them not being totally motivated. I think in this particular situation, because they had issues with some of the tenants, and I think the owner of the building, he wasn't too hands-on. He let the super do a lot of the work there because he had other projects on the go. And I think it was just getting to him, and it was becoming really stressful for him to have this building. And he just, that was the main reason he wanted to let it go.
Gotcha. And how did the financing look like for this project, both on the renovation side, down payment, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, so I mentioned the 1.3 VTB, 1.3 million. So we had to technically come up with 700 grand. But again, I consulted with people who've done this before, and they suggested getting a private second to decrease our down payment. So we ended up putting about $425,000 second on it. The rest we financed. I have a partner. We financed that together. The renovations, we didn't have the budget to, you know, spend $1 million on this and do everything to the nines. So we've tried to keep the unit renovations to about 10,000 per unit. And as part of that 12th unit that we were working on, the drawings had an addition. So we were supposed to build an addition. And because there's a big hill behind the property, we were supposed to build a retaining wall as well to support that and all that. So instead, we've applied for a minor variance to just work within the existing space. It's going to be a small bachelor unit, but that's going to save us a lot of money. So I would say our renovation budget is going to be somewhere around $200,000 to $250,000 at this point. And we are going to build a 13th unit as well. So on the opposite side of the building, there's a brick storage room that they're just using, you know, for like whatever lawn maintenance stuff and whatnot. But we had an engineer check it out, and we were actually told we can put a second story on that storage unit and turn it into a little loft.
Nice. Awesome.
That 250 for the renovation budget, how many units is that across?
Right.
So far we've renovated, I think, 4 units. So yeah, that's 4 units. And then we have another one that's going to be vacant shortly. And that's also for that 12th unit. And we built a laundry room as well. Laundry was supposed to go in that storage unit that I just described that we're going to put a second story on. Instead, we put the laundry in the main hallway to free up the space for that unit.
Understood. And I guess what's the game plan here in terms of tenant turnaround? So correct me if I'm wrong, we had 3 vacants on closing and one has left and then one is going to leave. Are these through conversations, natural turnover? Do you anticipate that the construction that you do in the basement may lead to more turnover as well? Like, do you have sort of a plan around that?
Well, there is no basement actually in this particular building, but I don't think.
Sorry, if not the basement, then I meant the additional units that you're adding in. My apologies.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to drive. As you guys know, when you're paying, you know, 900 or 1,000 a month or 750 a month, you're going to go through anything you can go through just to stay there, right?
Yeah.
In a lot of cases. So I don't think the construction is going to necessarily drive certain people away. But yeah, we had the one person that's leaving out of the two. She was in the process of being evicted by the previous owner. I think she was one of the main reasons the owner was stressed out. But that process has been delayed over and over. We've had our hearing adjourned twice now. So that's one. It's an eviction. The other one was an incentive that we provided to the tenant. And then the other couple that we had, we did provide incentives as well. For like, there was one situation where there was a father living with his teenage son. And he was, I just approached him and I said, hey, have you guys thought about moving? And he said, yeah, like this is kind of a tight space for us. So by providing him this incentive, it allowed him to move into a bigger space to have room for his son. And it was a win-win situation. And that's what we try to do when we negotiate.
Interesting. So when you were looking at this deal, it says, yeah, you know, it's very hard to find multifamilies that have underutilized space that can be converted in today's market. I feel like a lot of multifamily owners have maximized this space as much as possible. And so most people are looking at the cash for keys approach. So this is a really good approach on your side. But what do you look for in terms of making something a good deal? Is it ultimately like pulling out all of your capital, most of your capital, et cetera? What kind of valuation do you need to get to for that to happen? And how many units did you kind of assume you'd be able to turn over? Were you underwriting, like, there's a lot of questions there, I just realized. But were you underwriting on the three vacant units that you had been guaranteed almost, right? And that's all you were going to turn over? And these two extra ones are kind of like a cherry on top? Or how are you underwriting? Let's talk about that first.
Yeah, I was pretty conservative. So I had a five-year plan. I wasn't expecting to turn over a bunch of units right away. But within 5 years, I think if I remember correctly, we had projected turning over either 7 or 8 units out of the 11. We've already turned over five units. So we're doing pretty well. But yeah, once those units had been turned over, I projected the valuation of the building would be somewhere between 2.7 to 2.8 million. So that's a $700,000 or $800,000 increase from the original purchase price, which should put us in a position to pull out most of our capital, but not all. And I know that that may not sound attractive to some people, but I think the mindset, like I had to shift my mindset as well. I did consult with a bunch of people and they said, like, when you're in commercial multifamily, don't expect to get every single dollar out. It's a long-term play. It's not the same as a single family or a duplex. So if you have some money left in the deal after 5 years, then it's not the end of the world. That's just how it works.
Yeah, that makes sense, right? Like the multifamily is like more so generational wealth. Every time you do a rent increase every year across the entire building, you're adding tens of thousands of dollars to the value of the building easily every year. And as rents continue to outpace when people move out, now you're adding maybe 100,000 plus in the value just through one turnover. So it is a different game altogether. Mari, sorry to interrupt. I know that you wanted to call.
I was just going to say, like, we follow the same logic, right? Like if we can get to like a 5 to 10% net investment of our total invested capital, that's a home run. Like ultimately the simplest way of thinking about this is $2 million purchase price, $250K renovation, 2.25 all in. It's worth 2.7 to 2.8. That's like a $500K lift on one property, right? So when people get beyond like the net investment number, that's when you can kind of realize how strong commercial multifamily is. So, you know, really impressive there. I didn't want one last question on the underwriting on this one, because you're taking a VTB plus a private second. Was the net income of the building sufficient to carry that debt as it was, right? Or did you have to refinance to pay out the private second as soon as possible? Like, I'm just trying to understand what type of risk you're taking, because there's always risk and everyone has a different strategy, right? And it comes down to personal finances, but I'm just wondering how you went about it.
Yeah, no, it's still cash flows, even with the private second. It's not much, just a little bit. I think a couple $100 a month for the time being. And this was, again, this was with the original numbers. I haven't actually ran them once again to see where we're at now, because we have turned over some units. So the cash flow is going to still be positive in this situation while we continue to work. But the only challenge, as you guys, I'm sure, are aware, you can't refinance a property with a private to CMHC directly at this point. They changed their policies. So we're in a position now where we're kind of like, we can refinance the building most likely through a conventional loan. However, we're going to be facing 25-year AM and a higher rate just to keep it for 2 years so that we can qualify for a CMHC loan once the term's over. So I'm not sure if I want to do that or if we just keep the VTB in the second, because, you know, the numbers look pretty good with that. and hope that the policies will change in the future. So we're kind of in that situation right now, which I think a lot of investors are facing the same sort of question.
Right.
Yeah, that's a very good point there. We want to move on to your other project. We have some time to talk about it. So yeah. You mentioned earlier that you had four townhouses that you were looking at adding ADUs on each one. Could you explain that project? And yeah, sort of the same conversation we had with your current 11-plex, but let's sort of mitigate it over on the four townhouses. Give us a bit of the background.
Yeah, so March 2022, we closed on these four townhomes. It was a private, again, off-market deal through another realtor. We got a 1% VTB, 1% interest only VTB. The reason that I kind of pushed for it, like the financing was so incredible that, you know, I kind of had to go for it, but it was only for 1 year. And at that point, the rate was in the the prime was like 2.45%, right? And we all know what happened after March 2022, rates skyrocketed. So within 1 year, and by the way, all of these properties were tenanted. And yes. I was feeling pretty confident because I had worked with a paralegal on a couple projects that he'd be able to negotiate with them. Unfortunately, that wasn't the case for three out of the four tenants. They were so adamant about staying that they weren't budging. One of them did take a cash for keys offer, but we were stuck after a year. We had to refinance. We're looking at over 7% interest. So now we're bleeding pretty heavily on these projects, but we filed an N-13 for renovations and I just had to scramble. I had to figure out what are we going to do? Cause I can't just like, I have partners on this. They're trusting me to do this. I can't just fail. That's the biggest thing about taking other people's money. Like there's the pressure of succeeding and making sure you don't let people down. So the idea here was to go with a duplex conversion to be able to qualify for that N-13 renovation because they started to really clamp down on people doing fake renovations to get tenants out, right? And the cheapest way to do it was to separate the main floor and the upper level rather than going down into the basement. It was going to be more expensive to the basements were unfinished. Mm-hmm. So we got all the plans done, everything. The tenants kept fighting all the way up until the hearing date, which happened about a year and a half later. Takes a long time to get an N-13, by the way. At least in my situation. So, yeah.
And where was it?
In Welland.
Welland.
And when did you have this hearing? It was pretty recent, it sounds like, or?
Yeah, the hearing happened, I think, in December 2023, if I remember correctly.
Very recent. Okay, yeah. Gotcha. No. Yeah.
Yeah.
So how did that go?
It went as well as it can go. Like the tenants had, they get free legal counsel, right? As a tenant, you get to consult with a paralegal or a lawyer. I'm not sure which one. And basically, because we had the permit, an approved building permit, we had all the drawings, we have the minor variants, we have everything ready to go. Their legal counsel told them, like, kind of don't really have a choice here. So they took an incentive from us anyway. And that was it. All the tenants moved.
We've got a very similar property that we've been debating what to do with it. And I've been on the side of conversion. But because two townhouses, well, and I'm assuming each townhouse is not, sorry, four townhouses. But I'm assuming each townhouse is not too large in size. After you convert this, like how much square feet roughly would each unit be?
Yeah, they're in the ballpark of like 450 square feet a unit. They're really small. The townhomes were just under 1,000 square foot each.
Right.
But we do have some nice qualities in the main floor unit, for example. You have access to a nice yard and a basement, so you have lots of storage. The upper unit's a little bit smaller. But yeah, we're projecting to get about 1,500 for the main floor and then 1,300 up for the upper unit.
It's a studio for both. All the units are going to be studios, essentially,
right?
They're going
to be one bedroom.
Yeah. Okay. Like Toronto size micro condo units.
They're not that small. Like 450 square feet. I know that seems really small, but I think that's pretty normal. A lot of our units in the Niagara region are that size. So
really
interesting. I mean, I lived in a tiny place, that one bedroom Hamilton that I described earlier, that was like 350 square feet. And it felt like a lot of space because I had a backyard and I had a basement.
So is there parking? Is there laundry? Because I ask all of these things because it is, you know, when you get a tenant that's okay with going in a smaller unit, there needs to be other pros to it. If it has like no parking, no laundry, and it's a small unit, these are just assumptions. I would assume that it might cause trouble in finding the right tenant.
Yeah. There is separate laundry.
Okay.
One of the units are in the basement for the main floor tenant, and then we put a stacked laundry up in the upper unit.
Okay.
And there's tandem parking, which is allowed in Welland, but there's also street parking, right? You're talking about a town that's smaller. It's not like Toronto where you have millions of people. You have about 55,000 people in Welland. Street parking shouldn't be an issue there if in case somebody doesn't want to do the tandem parking thing.
And how much are these rentals costing you? Because this isn't like a normal, like people think duplex conversion. Let's finish up the basement. Let's add all new electrical, all new plumbing, like stuff like that, right? How much are these rentals costing you on a, like a, call it a per townhouse basis, roughly?
Yeah. By the way, it took a lot of work to bring this budget down. So the it ended up being about 70K all in, including carrying costs and new appliances and like everything, right?
Per townhouse.
Per townhouse.
But did you have to do all four at the same time?
No, I'm doing them sequentially because the tenants are leaving at different times. And it actually works out really well because that allows us to refi, do one, refi it, have some capital for the next one, that sort of thing.
Are they okay. All four separate titles?
Yeah.
That makes a lot more sense. Yeah, because we're thinking if it's on one title, one lot, then you are sort of at the mercy of the zoning. But because it's four separate titles, you can ADU one, ADU another, ADU another, ADU another. The one that we have is three towns, one title, one lot. So we are at the mercy of whatever the city zoning is. But it's a cool strategy to see what are you doing to make it work.
Like if you merge title on all four of these, you could have a nice like CMHC exit potential there, right? Like,
well, that's the thing. I don't need to merge to get CMHC. So I've already consulted with a mortgage broker because they're all like side by side, all basically connected to each other. They will allow you to get a CMHC across all four, even though they have separate titles.
But you have different partners on each, no?
Yeah. So that's a thing. I've had conversations. So I think this is part of the managing expectations thing that I've had to really work on this year. Just letting partners know where we're at, the cash flow, but also that once these projects are complete, we might be looking at a buyout because some of them want out anyway. Some of them want to take their money and do something else. So, hey, like when we do this, we might be in a position to get one mortgage across all four. Maybe you guys can consider a buyout at that point. You can take your capital and invest in something different.
Right. Okay. That makes more sense because we've had similar conversations with some of our clients and like client has this company in a corporation and this company in a corporation plus a mall just for the sole purpose of not merging title. And CMHC ends up having a problem with it. You can remove the mom, but then there's a risk that the city might just merge title. I don't think they're doing that as much anymore, but I know a couple of years ago that was always a risk, right? If they realize same property owners, they might just merge it without asking you. And I guess it varies per city, but this is actually Welland as well, similar to yours. But okay, so that's interesting. So, you know, you could refinance this personally. You could sell off individual like ADU converted like townhouses if you wanted to. You could merge or not even merge, but you could do a blanket mortgage across the entire portfolio. So what do the overall numbers look like on a project like this? Because March 2022 was hot market, peak market, right? So, you know, what was like purchase price? What's renovation spend? What are we expecting on ARV?
Well, we've only completed one so far. Another one's about 50% complete so far, the second one. But they were each purchased for $375,000.
That's pretty good price.
So these were like three bedroom townhomes, maybe more like a 2+ den on the end units because they kind of have a curved roof or a sloped roof. And then we just had, so I mentioned we spent about 70K including carrying costs and everything. And we just had the one property appraised at 505.
Wow.
Gotcha. That's pretty good, especially given that, you know, purchase in the peak market, right? So those are some exciting projects, George. And you know, we've been going for about almost an hour here. So at this point in the podcast, we just want to ask you kind of two main questions here. The first is like, where do you see your business growing to in the next 2 to 3 years, right? Because you've done from 2017 to now, it's been quite the growth, quite the journey, right? So where do you see your business going from here?
Cash flow is going to be a main focus in, well, I'd say that's maybe more of like a 4 or 5 year plan. But once we get to that point where we want to just replace our income, I think we're going to sell off maybe a smaller property, maybe one or two smaller ones, and dump all that cash into an apartment building, not have like, you know, maximum loan to value, 80, 70, 80%, maybe have a lower loan to value. and just use the cash flow from that building to fund our lifestyle. So that's the game plan for the next couple of years.
Solid. And for anyone that's like a newer or medium-sized investor that's kind of listened to this podcast and gone relatively inspired here from your conversation, what kind of advice do you have to share for them? Any lessons learned, any risks, anything like that?
There's always tons of lessons. There's always so much to learn. There's a lot. I think the biggest thing lately that I've learned, and I think, Austin, we kind of talked about this as well when you were on my podcast, but it's the importance of not doing too much to the point where it impacts your life, like the stress levels, you know. It's great that you want to strive for your goals and accomplish all these things, but at the same time, you have to be very aware of what it's doing to your body, to your mind, to your like mental state. So that's, I think that's a priority for me moving forward, because I have been under a lot of stress just from these different projects. So I want to make sure that I'm focusing on my health, getting exercise in, like I'm speaking to a nutritionist, doing all these things to take care of myself moving forward.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. I think for a lot of younger investors, we get carried away, right? We jump from project to project to project, and we always feel like we have to keep on going until we burn ourselves out or until we get caught offside. But I think now more than ever, I think a learning lesson, to your point, like the past year and a half, with the market turning, a lot more people realize how important it is to sort of manage lifestyle with investing, right? It's easy to grow when the market is like going 10, 15% year over year, and you want to. But when you get hit with the reality of that market shift at any time, then you start to understand the full picture. Okay, investing is a long-term game. It's not a race. Take your time with it and just manage the stress levels throughout. Anyways, George, it was amazing having you on. Definitely got a lot of golden nuggets from it. And I love that we talked a little bit about projects that didn't necessarily go well on surface level, but you were able to pivot and find different exit strategies, taking advantage of the new financing products that are out there, right? I don't think enough people are thinking creatively to figure out how they can get themselves out of tough situations. If people want to connect with you, learn more about your journey, or even check out your podcast, how could they best do so?
Yeah, you can check out the Well Off podcast, which is on all the different platforms. Austin was obviously on there. I've had tons of people on there as well that you may have heard of or that have been on this podcast. And then if you want to connect with me, you can go to welloff.ca. There's a link to book a call. I'm happy to work again with anyone that's looking to buy an apartment building in Brantford, Hamilton, Niagara. More than happy to connect with you and guide you through that process.
Awesome. Really appreciate it, man. And if you guys enjoyed this podcast, make sure to like it, share it with a friend, leave us a 5-star review and comment. It brings great guests like George on our podcast. And until next time, everyone, invest smarter and live better. Take care, all.